Kroger, yeah. Anyway, all right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we have the latest in our series of periodic comic roundtables. First of all, introduce Mr. Walt Rebillard, who has stepped away from the mic for the moment. Mr. Adrian Smith.
Hola.
Hey, Adrian, you got us on speakerphone?
On?
Sounds like you're about a block away from your mic.
Okay, is that better?
Much better, thank you, sir.
There we go.
I love the effect of the sound of running to the mic to catch
it. suddenly, theater of the mind, I love it.
I actually have the mic, it's upright position rather than it's usable position, that's why.
That's what she said. Awesome. Yeah.
Let's try this again. Yeah, I had the mic on mute because I had a dog that was going moderately crazy.
Yeah, I feel like I have a dog who does that too.
What kind of dog do you have?
She's a mutt. She's a combination between a Chihuahua and a Jack Russell terrorist.
She's a rescue dog.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seriously.
That's wonderful. Good on you. Good on you. Yeah.
Take her up to the Alps and rescue some skiers, please.
No, she would probably just beg them for tequila.
Ah. Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Right?
Oh, that was an old joke. Hey, Jason Tondra was here, too.
Hi, everyone, and Ace Grant is here to talk to some of my old friends again. Abe, Smith, lovely to hear your accent, as always.
Thank you very much.
I'm just jealous. I've always wanted a cool accent.
And for those of you who don't know, Jason is Dr. Comics at Blogspot.com, a professor of English at, what were you at there, Jason?
It's called the College of Coastal Georgia, which is, we are now officially the smallest college in the Georgia State College system now.
Oh, cool. Hope you got a nice watch for that or something. That's great.
We have a nice what?
Got a nice watch for that or something. Or maybe.
No, we don't. We have lots of anxiety about enrollment instead. But we're very glad to be here, and we're growing, and I go wherever they pay me money to teach comic books.
Great. And those of you, just to give you Jason's credentials, Field Guide to Comics from Vigilance Press, Archer Lives from Vigilance Press, Jason, what else do we have in your bibliography?
Well, we're doing the Cosmic book for you.
You're doing the Cosmic for Stark City, which is in development right now, and it was going to be super great, but Dan Houser blabbed it, so, man, that was out there.
And I was very honored to write the Silver District, the downtown section for Stark City.
Which will be coming out very soon. We're going to start releasing the neighborhoods this week, because Walt just hosted the last, and Adrian just finished laying out the last of the neighborhoods for Stark City for the backers.
Well, that was enormous fun to write, and I had a great time doing it.
It's great stuff. And last but certainly not least, Mr. Andrew Collis.
Yes, indeed. Or I guess since the cat's out of the bag now, for those who care, also known as Alan LeGros. So you can always watch my YouTube video that explains why I have two names. But yes, hi. How you doing, guys? Nice to be with you. I'm sorry, what?
You have a pseudonym?
It's a long story. I had to make a YouTube video about it. But long story short, I have a professional name that I used as an actor, which is my real name, my legal name, but as a writer, and also just due to some life instances, I started using my middle name of Andrew and my mother's maiden name of Collis after she died. Yeah. But unfortunately, I've had to sort of connect the two because I'm all over IMDb and what have you as Alan LeGros, not Andrew Collis. Yeah. Yeah. And when we went to Kickstarter, it was advised that I should tie my two worlds together for whatever popularity. I doubt it. I swear to God, anybody who's seen me in anything that would then want to go spend money on a comic, that person might be scary to me because,
you know what? Kevin Bacon number.
And my Kevin Bacon number is 3.
Oh, awesome. Excellent. That's
actually, cool. I think it's 2 now.
Really?
Ooh, I haven't done it in a while, but I think it's now 2. I was in something that someone was in with Kevin, that someone else was in a Kevin Bacon movie. So I think I'm at that level. I'm 1 degree from him, or 2 degrees. But yeah, no, what scared me was the day that a friend of mine said, hey, I saw your YouTube video. This was about 5 years ago. And I said, I don't have any YouTube videos. And she sent me a link. And it was some creepy German guy who had just put up a collection of video clips of me and other fat actors, and it was really unnerving, and I made a decision to separate myself at that moment in time. 5 years later, I'm coming back around to actually linking the two together, and I'm in the process of legally changing my name to Andrew Collis from Alan LeGros, so very soon this will be a moot point for all.
So you're like the Canadian David Hasselhoff.
Hardly.
You know, Walt, you just trumped every joke I had. I haven't seen recently, like 5 minutes. So.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I've got the bottle of tequila and a cheeseburger and a floor later, so I'll videotape that for you all.
No, I hate to derail because we're talking about comics, but I didn't realize you were in Battlefield Earth.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Can we not talk? We're going to talk about that. Okay, yeah, I'm in that. But you know what I'm more proud of? I'll tell you what I'm more proud of. I have 3 guest starring appearances on Eureka, and that's way more important to me.
My wife loved that show.
I'll tell you real fast, it was the greatest show I ever got to work on. When I went to the audition for it, I didn't really want to go because it was for big actors, and I got a little tired of the typecasting.
Yeah.
And then I showed up, and I was pretty much the only fat guy there. Everybody else was a tall guy. And I went up against, one of the guys I went up against was a guy named Chris Heyerdahl, who's a great guy. And Chris, I had been in movies Chris had starred in. So yeah. I was kind of like, what am I doing at this audition? This is so above my pay grade.
Yeah.
And I got it. I got it because the casting director in BC, in Vancouver, Stuart Aitken, really believed in me and pushed for me with LA. And the director really loved me and pushed for me. And on set, he actually took me aside and said, I want you to know, he goes, I wish you could see the emails that went back and forth between me and the studio. You're not here because you're the best fat actor. You're not here because you're the best tall actor. You're here because you were the best actor we saw. And I was, like, blown away by that. And they brought me back twice, two other appearances. I was supposed to come back for a fourth, but I couldn't make the scheduling worked out. And that's so. But, yeah, so I'm very proud of that person.
What's the name of your character on the show?
Seth Osborne.
Seth Osborne. All right. My wife will know you instantly.
I was in an episode called Purple Haze, I believe it was, which is about the plants that make everybody go to sleep. I was in another episode about the glowing god is in the details. It's about glowing and God and all that. And then the third episode was literally a cameo. It was the most amazing thing. They flew me out to Vancouver for 3 days to shoot for 20 minutes, paid everything. I was like, hey, no wonder this industry's going broke. You just flew my ass to Vancouver for 2 lines. You could have anybody do it. But that said, that's how much they liked me, and I was really happy for the experience. I'm very very proud of that show.
Hey, speaking of flying, Man of Steel, who's seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, segue. That is master.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was really well done there, laugh. Shut up, Canadian boy.
Hey, put down that hammer, Mike.
I'm on my lunch hour, guys. 1 o'clock rolls around, and I got to go back to doing Unix. So that sounded terrible. They're very nice guys, nothing against them. But let's talk about Man of Steel. Who's seen it?
Okay, Man of Steel. Who wants to go first?
Hey, I've not seen it, so you can count me out. I can rant about stuff about it, but I've not seen it. So.
Okay, you're out.
Walt, have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
What did you say?
I thought it was a great popcorn movie. I thought the, and you know, for anybody who hasn't seen it, shut the video off. But I thought the ending was a little over the top. I mean, smashing an entire city, two guys just duking it out, and then of course the inevitable thing that pretty much crushed Superman for everybody in the theater when he has his final moment with Zod. I mean, it just. To me, there was just something missing. It was an enjoyable movie to go with friends on a Saturday night and laugh at all the, like, you know, the aerial Mach 3 punching. But I mean, other than that, I'm still a big Christopher Reeve fan of the original, and I think that if you're gonna default to a Superman movie, to me that was a lot more fun. The innocence and integrity of Superman was protected, and it felt more like the experience I would want out of a Superman movie rather than what I got.
Mm. You know, Superman killed Zod in Superman. Christopher Reeve Superman killed Zod in Superman 2.
Actually, no. There's footage that never made it to the final cut that Richard Donner shot of, I think, the army leading the three of them away in handcuffs.
That was used for the TV when they showed it on TV.
Yeah. So basically, technically, we don't see them die, so we can argue. We can argue. But the point is, and Walt is right on this, this was not a Superman movie. This was a, wow, that guy looks kind of like Superman and sort of has his backstory, and holy shit, how many people just died? I can't even go as far as to say it was a good popcorn movie, because there's just plot holes in it. Why is Lois Lane? Why does he need Lois to go on the... Why is Zod asking for Lois to come? Oh, so she can be there later for this crucial plot point that Zod would have no reason to need her there for. Huh? it's sloppy. It's sloppily written, but what they do is, with everything they do in Hollywood now with the big genre films, they just overwhelm you with flash and pomp and circumstance, but no substance.
One of the things I did like about it, though, and I just thought it was really well done, was the interplay between Feyora and Christopher Maloney's character, that colonel. I mean, the last scene where they're pretty much, not the last scene, but the scene when they're in the small town together and things are about to get real, real fast. There was just that connection between the two of them, and you know, I actually held my breath for a second. I was like, wow, that was awesome.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's the best thing in that movie.
So, Jason, what'd you think about it?
My review of this film is called Superman Saves, Everyone Else Takes Full Damage. the reason why I didn't like the film is not the reason why most people don't like the film. I actually didn't have that much of a problem with Superman killing Zod at the end, because I remember reading the John Byrne story in which Superman killed Zod with kryptonite back in the 80s. And I just wanted the death to be dealt with seriously, and I felt that the actor who played Superman, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, he sold it. I really did believe that he sold it, and I was okay with that. I just wanted it to be treated seriously. That's not what bugged me. What bugged me were two things. First is the Space Jesus imagery was way over the top. I counted at least three crucifixion poses.
Oh, yeah.
The scene in which he goes to the church and asks for help, that was fine. But then he's backlit by this stained glass window of Jesus on his knees asking for help.
Yep.
And I didn't even catch the fact that he's 33 years old until I read somebody else's review that also pointed it out.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So
oh,
the whole Space Jesus stuff was, I thought, way overblown. And I have to quote Chris Sims in his great review on Comics Alliance, which is called On My World, S is for Sucks. where he says, look, if you're going to make your movie about Space Jesus, I'm pretty sure that story doesn't end with Space Jesus breaking someone's neck.
Yeah, pretty much. My buddy and I took one of my best friends and I, we went to see it. We go see a movie every Wednesday. We're old men and we're old friends and it's what we do.
Yeah.
And he's not a superhero fan at all, but he was coming to this on the chance of, okay, he really liked X-Men. He really loved Avengers, so maybe this will be fun. And we sat down, and at one point halfway through, I just looked at him and I went, oh, I get it. It's Space Jesus fighting Space Hitler. And that was it.
But honestly, I'm used to the Space Jesus stuff because it's in almost every Superman movie. Where I lost the movie was Pa Kent. And those of you that are into Superman or you saw the trailers before the movie even came out, you know exactly what I'm talking about. In this movie, there are two fathers for Superman. And one of them is the ghost dad. Who says Superman?
Not Bill Cosby, though. No.
Yeah.
The one is Kal-El.
One father is the ghost dad who says, you can save them. You can save everyone. And he's right. And the other dad is the human father, who says to Clark, you have to hide and not save people because they wouldn't understand you. And that guy is wrong. In the context of this film, Kal-El is right and Pa Kent is wrong. Okay. This is where the movie gets really personal. So, like, my father adopted me when I was an infant. And I never knew my real father. I realized all of this while I was watching the movie, by the way. This is exactly why I get so worked up about Superman. When I was watching that movie and Pa Kent grabs little Clark and says, you are my son, in that sort of, you know, moment where he says, maybe you're not my blood, but you are my son. For that 5 seconds, Kevin Costner was playing my dad.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Any movie in which Pa Kent is wrong and Jor-El is right is going to lose me. Right? Because Superman is not an alien. I mean, he's physically an alien, but he's really supposed to be from Kansas, you know? He's supposed to be this...
Well,
he's supposed to be culturally human.
Let me jump in. Let me jump in. Hang on. I want to stop you before you go too far, because you're on a point that matters. A lot of modern comic book and superhero fans looked at the movie Kill Bill when Bill gives the whole speech about how Clark Kent is who Superman puts on, and that's how he sees us as weak and enough. These are the people who like this kind of movie. These are the people who don't like Superman normally. What they all fail to understand is that, no. Clark didn't know he was an alien until he was 18 or whatever it was. Clark Kent is who he is. Superman is who he sees us being able to become.
Well, now, to be fair, it's different in different decades and different writers of Superman. And some people have written Superman as that character from Kill Bill, right? The guy who tends to be human for some bizarre reason that nobody can understand, right?
But they're the exception, not the norm.
But you and me and a lot of us that grew up on books like Burns' Man of Steel, for example, you know, our Superman is human. And the S does not mean hope in Kryptonian. It's not a Kryptonian leisure suit or anything.
Yeah.
It's a homemade costume sewn by his parents with an S that means Superman, because that's what Lois Lane calls him.
Exactly.
Right. And so we're talking about a human Superman instead of an alien Superman. And yes, there are lines where in this film, Superman says, you know, I'm raised in Kansas. That's about as American as you can get, or whatever. But there are also, for every line that he does that, there's five times when he is disavowing his humanness and it's asserting his alienness. Such as, for example, when he kisses Lois Lane and he says, oh, I think that rule only applies to humans, right?
True.
So we had an alien Superman, and they obviously did it on purpose, but they lost. Alien Superman's no good.
So I think we can agree, for those of us who've seen it, not a great Superman movie?
No.
Now, I saw someone on Facebook complaining about how they always reinterpret old characters for the film, present them in a different way. But isn't that what they did with Batman so successfully?
Yeah, but the thing is Batman is a revenge fantasy, where Superman is an immigrant triumph fantasy. It's a big difference. Or, which I just realized from what you've said recently, because I'm adopted as well, and I never realized, I agree with you. Superman is that identifier to me, because I was raised by people who aren't me.
Yeah.
I was raised by people who, I learned their values and their things, but I'm still different enough from them every day that I know I'm not their blood.
That's right.
So,
any movie in which Pa Kent is wrong, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And it's got nothing to do with logic. And you might even have a really great movie. And I read Mark Waid's review of Superman Returns, by the way. And he actually really liked the way they did Pa Kent. He thought it was really gutsy. And he actually wrote, I wish I had written that scene. And so, you know, you can like that scene. But people like you and me, we're not going to dig it. Now, your comment, though, Mike, about Batman and stuff being reinterpreted.
Well, a lot of folks have come forth that the Batman they see in there, you know, the Bruce Wayne in Christopher Nolan's movie, isn't really a great detective.
I hate the Nolan films. I don't love the Nolan films. My friend loves the Nolan films, and I tell him he's not Batman. He's not a detective. There's no detective stuff in it at all. It's literally just kicking the crap out of him.
I mean, usually everyone else figures everything else out before Bruce Wayne does.
Exactly, yeah. I remember the first one. I mean, I've only seen the first two. I refuse to watch the third one, because the first two are just like, the first one, there's a bit where he has to figure something out, and someone's got to done the work for him. I think, okay, well, that's just terrible. So.
Have you guys seen the College Humor Batman series they did?
No.
Oh, my God. Go, after you're done, everybody listening to this podcast, go look at the College Humor's Batman. They do four or five vignettes. And, like, seriously, it's spoofing the Nolan stuff, but it's doing it so brilliantly because they make Batman just such a chunkhead. Yeah. And it's like, there you go. Yeah. I think we want a good superhero film. You got to get Max Dillon to direct it, Steven Spielberg to produce it. There we go. And then be able to take kids to see Superman again. What a novel concept that you could take a six-year-old to a Superman film.
It'd be crazy, exactly, yeah. That's what I think. I love it too. That young,
so. Speaking of superheroes for kids, anyone read Batman 66 this last week?
Hated it.
Yes.
I did read it. Who hated it? Who was just
me?
Okay. Tell us why you hated it.
I'm sorry?
Tell us why you hated it.
I hate camp. I'm not a fan of camp.
So this was probably a bad book for you then.
Very bad book. I was like, well, what is this? Oh, dear God.
All right.
Well, what did you? You didn't. You weren't surprised that it was camp, though, was it? I mean, you knew.
I didn't know what it was. No, I didn't know what it was until I read it, and then when I started reading, I went, "Oh, this is the '60s Batman TV show as a comic book." Oh.
I thought that was clear. Yeah, Batman 66. I thought it was in the title. So.
Dude, I didn't know. I thought there was a six dropped off, and it was gonna be Batman versus demons. Who knows?
I guess it could have been like the JFK. Series they did with in DC, right, where it was just Batman in 1966.
Ooh, it could have been Batman and Robin driving down Highway 66 like a David Lynch film. That would have been awesome.
I would write that book all year long. I would love that book.
Wait, what'd you think of it?
If people have listened to previous podcasts, they may know I love the Batman TV series personally, but this book, I don't think it actually represented the Batman TV series. I think it was almost too big for the stories you see in a TV series. This was like, you would not see this in the TV series. This and I like the artwork. The guy who drew it was good. The rhythm was good. But the actual, I prefer that if it's books based on actual TV episodes or movies for trying to get more photo realistic characters. So it was just difficult to even picture. It was Adam West as Batman because it didn't look like Adam West. So it could have been. It almost felt to me like it was a version of the 66 possible comic stories at that era. But for the TV series, I didn't think so. No.
Okay, well, go ahead, Jason.
Go ahead, Mike, please.
I was going to say I liked it, but I see your point because it really is. I mean, they didn't have a budget that kind of big, except maybe for the Batman 66 movie.
Yeah.
You know, at no point.
Even that was kind of, lots of slanted rooms where they run in, beat a couple of bad guys up and go, oh, the Joker's got away again. And it was just massive. There wasn't a lot of plot. I mean, it was a short, I mean, obviously when they did the collection theory, actually it would be a longer story because you probably have three parts put together. But it just didn't seem to be a TV episode, which is what you're trying to capture. It just seemed a bit odd, so.
It's an old Urban action scene. What were you going to say, Jason?
That's actually what I liked about it. Because it seems like the people who were doing the comics said, okay, well, let's take the characters and the tone of the show, but then do stuff in the comic that they never would have been able to do with the show because they didn't have the money.
I didn't feel like the characters, apart from when they started saying their catchphrases. That's the only time. Well, okay, that's Burt Ward's for Robin because
it's short. I mean, if you it would be like the first 15 minutes of an episode. It would be very short. But I thought the most interesting thing about it was the technical aspects of the book. And those of you that have read this, if you haven't read it yet, you know, I'm reading it on an iPad, and you read it in Comixology with the guided view technology, and so which is what it's designed for. So as you're looking, when you look at a panel and you push the screen to make the next panel move, instead of the panel moving, you just see new word balloons and new sound effects appear on the panel you're already looking at.
I thought that was pretty fun.
Yeah, and this is taking the form and making it adapt to the technology and doing stuff that you can't normally do. When you're looking at a picture of the Riddler, and then suddenly all the color becomes super saturated. You don't see the panel move. You just see the color pop. This is an example of what you can do with a digital comic that you can't do with regular comics. And I thought that was great that they did that.
I'm not necessarily interested to see what the print version comes out like. Because it's going to be completely different.
Yeah, you're right. They'll have to do a print version, and it won't get a lot of those advantages that the digital one can do. There are some comics that when you try to move them into a digital space, they lose half of the things that make them good. Watchmen being a classic example. Whereas if you take this is the opposite. If you take this thing out of the digital space and try to put it into print, you're going to lose half of the things that make that book worth looking at.
You know, it's a fun little action scene that you could easily see in a higher budget version of the TV show.
Yeah.
You know, someone was talking about Dark Horse's new Star Wars series, and they said it read like really good fan fiction.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably the best review you can give a Star Wars comic at this point. And I kind of felt the same way about this. It felt like really good fan fiction of the old TV show. I mean, not exactly the same, but it's being written by somebody who was probably, you know, not even born when the TV show came out.
Right, right.
So. Plus, it didn't have Catwoman or Batgirl in it, and that's a strike against the straight away. So.
Big strike. Huge strike.
Well, it depends which Catwoman for me, but yeah, I hear you. I'm a Julie Newmar fan. Sorry, yeah. Lad.
Yes, so I'm trying to think. I can't think. I can always get the two mixed up, and I think that is the one. That's the best one. Wasn't Lee Merriweather was the movie Catwoman?
That's right. Lee Merriweather.
Yeah, it's Julie Newmar everywhere. She's lovely. We love the Julie.
Yes. I concur. Hey, so Marvel, this Age of Ultron Infinity thing, are they doing some kind of big crisis, multiverses colliding thing over in Marvel, or what's going on there? Who knows?
Can I rant for about this for a second?
Could I possibly stop you? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. I'm Canadian. All you have to do is say, please don't, and I'll go, okay.
I'm a
Canuck. Okay, and I don't care if you agree or disagree with me, people. This is an opinion. I'm allowed to have it, so... it boils down to this. Marvel has been trying and needing to do a crisis since 1985 when DC did their first one. They have been so afraid because DC has had the balls to do it repeatedly. Marvel has been afraid, I think, of two things. One, looking like they're copying DC. And two, seeing that up until New 52, DC has had very little success with these reboots. So they're afraid of them. They came close in 2000, and I personally, honestly feel they should have shit-canned the entire Marvel Universe when they started the Ultimate line and just moved everything to the Ultimate line and developed it from there. Instead, they created something really good and then took all the talent from the Ultimate line and kept putting it back on the mainstream Marvel Universe, which just got more complicated and more in-depth. I'm reading DeFalco's Spider-Girl series right now because I never read it and I wanted to read it, and it's so interesting seeing how he saw the 70s Marvel Universe evolving into a 90s comic that had an actual timeline in it, which was very interesting. Not good, but interesting. DC's New 52 is, love it or hate it, was a success for them. Marvel has been shit-dicking around it, pardon my language, and fiddling at it, but honest to God, enough foreplay, Marvel, fuck or get out of the bed. One or the other. If I didn't put too fine a point on that.
I hope they get out of the bed, because I like those old stories, and I don't want them to be retconned out of existence.
Okay.
And although you can say that they should have shifted everything over to the Ultimates is so contrary to everything that I love in superhero comics, I'm glad that it died.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's an opinion. But
okay, what about
time, Ultimate Spider-Man
book
the best.
Itself?
The actual book itself?
What about the actual story, yeah.
I hated at the beginning the first three issues of it, and by the end I enjoyed it.
Right. See, I there's some things that really bugged me about it. Number one, there was not enough Ultron in it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Number two, Captain America... always bugged me with Captain America. Captain America for the first three issues effectively sat in a corner and cried. And that is not Captain America to me. Captain America should be taking point, he should be shouting orders all the way through. He's just sitting there, oh, his shield's busted, oh, he's defeated now, he can't do anything. Oh, dear, poor Captain America. Horrible, hated that, just annoyed me. Wolverine is the most... His solution is the most ham-fisted, ridiculous solution to solving a timeline problem I've ever seen in my life. Someone who's been like, we've been the X-Men and had stuff going on around him for whatever, how many years the X-Men have existed in the Marvel Universe, and just basically go, just stab it, that'll go away. That was terrible. And the one that bugged me more than anything else, Brian Hitch, I bought it because of the Brian Hitch art book. He had years to do this, and he only lasted 3 years before he dropped out. That bugged that out of me as well.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Wolverine is one of those guys where every problem looks like a hand, looks like a nail, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I don't read a lot of Marvel. I've not read a Marvel crossover since Secret Invasion. Didn't get Siege. I didn't get Fear Itself. Mainly because it comes down to now, if it's a Marvel crossover, it's always going to have every single Avenger character in it, every single X-Men character in it. Nobody else cares. It doesn't make a difference about anybody else. It's only focused on them, effectively those two teams.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, I'll give this a try. It's Ultron. I've got my three favourite Marvel villains. Ultron, Thanos, and Galactus. What crossover have we got this year? Ultron, Thanos, and Galactus. They're trying to draw money out of me. But it's just crazy. I was really, really annoyed that Ultron literally showed up in the last issue and then got basically defeated, you know, kind of timeline retrospectively, but... I don't know. I was disappointed. It should have been 10 issues. They could have got away with doing it in 5 issues.
I think it was cool that they had everything written and done before they solicited it, the event, so that there wasn't any long legs. That was nice.
Yeah, it's actually a fascinating idea for them.
Also, I kind of want to see a Doctor Who Wolverine crossover now.
You just stab everything.
Okay, as a Canadian, I am sick of Wolverine. Literally. Done.
Imagine you must have posters from him all around Canada.
No, no, we don't. We actually don't. No. He's the worst kind of Canadian you can have. He's like, you know, they use the term ugly American. Well, he's an ugly Canadian. You know?
You know, I know that he's incredibly popular and he makes a bajillion dollars, but I have to confess I never liked him.
Thank you.
He was on part of the Silver Street era with the out in the Outback. That was my era of X-Men. After that, I kind of drifted off. He was a pretty cool character, but keep putting him in 1,000 different books and be on it. Oh, look, it's a new Avengers team. Oh, it's got to be on that. It just drives you crazy. They've got so many characters to draw from that they keep reusing the same one over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and we talked about this once before, Walt. I believe Walt and I talked about this one time when we were on. And it's something the guys from the House to Astonish podcast make a really good point, which is after 1990, Marvel has not introduced a successful character. And the closest you come is Deadpool, and he's actually, I think, it's 1991, and he's at the end of 1990 that he gets introduced.
To be fair, Marvel and DC both had this problem. You can't introduce a successful character unless they're reusing the name of an old character.
Well, ironically enough, DC seems to have a problem now. They can't even reintroduce characters that are popular in the 70s and 80s because everyone says, oh, they're not Batman and Superman, the books die after 8 issues. So,
but this is this is the corporate model, right? This is the problem with the corporate ownership, is that you've got Time Warner and you've now got Disney, but even before that, you've got corporate people going, well, I want money. And every month I expect a fat check from that corporation that I've spent money in buying stock and all that in. So as a result, the editors are obliged to make, you know, if it's not selling 5,000 issues a month, cancel it. You know,
actually, the limit is 30,000 issues a month.
Is it? I heard that it was 5,000 was the new one, like with the new DC stuff, where books that were under 5,000 are guaranteed the axe. Now they moved up to 30,000 now.
It was 30,000 when New 52 launched. It was 30,000. That's why Static got canceled, for example.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. So I think pretty much every single New 52 book that I picked up, apart from the Superman and Batman books, have probably been cancelled and replaced by other books.
I keep reading Earth 2 and I keep hoping it won't get canned.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it will because there's rumours of a Batman Earth 2 book coming out, isn't there?
You're absolutely right, though, to talk about the change in the way that books publish. You know, I was at the Denver Comic Con last month and Denny O'Neill was there, for example, and he was talking about when he was working on Green Lantern, Green Arrow, you know? And this is a book that was doing poorly. And so he was put on the book, and they said, look, just do whatever you want, because it can't go any lower in sales, right? So just give it some time, and then let it breathe. And, like, so we slowly started building up a readership over 6, 12 issues. Now, to be fair, even Denny O'Neill couldn't keep that book from getting canceled, because it was canceled underneath him after about a year and a half. But it had a year and a half, you know, where today that wouldn't happen. It drops below a certain number and they just get rid of it. It's only independent books, you know, it's creator-owned books. And this is a great time for us to segue into our Kickstarter that we should be talking about.
Thank you.
That allows creators to put a book out and for the love of the game, you know, kind of let it grow organically instead of face fight or flight after 3 issues.
Yes, it's the Morbius book that Marvel, that's been canned. I think that's 8 issues in. 8 issues seems to be the number now. Used to be about 12. Sometimes you used to get 14, 15. Like in the 90s when they were just chucking everything at everybody as much as they could. You know, give a character a gun. He's a new character. Go, go, go. That was the last 12 issues. Now it seems to be 8 issues. And after 3 or 4 issues, you just kind of go, okay, this is going to die. And it's for sure.
Listen, what they're doing is they're approaching their comic book releases the way Fox approached TV series in the 90s and the early 2000s, which is, you know, they were canceling them before they even put them on the goddamn air, you know?
Yeah. That's still true. That's still true.
In the UK, we get so many series over here that are like 13 episodes. We go, okay, and they big it up as being the next big thing, and you go onto like Wikipedia to find out how many seasons there are. Oh, but it was canceled 6 months ago. It's madness.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about heroic.
Let's.
So, Walt, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Walt ran a Kickstarter for a book that Andrew has written called Heroic. Kickstarter just launched. We'll have the link in the show notes. And who wants to talk about it first, Walt or Andrew?
I want Walt to talk about it first because I talk about this way too much all the time.
All right, so for me, this pretty much started right around 2006. And I was on the Mutants and Masterminds board, and I come across this illustration of this lady clad in red, white, and blue.
And, by Darren Ballmer, no less.
Yeah, and I just thought the image was a lot of fun, and it struck that, I don't know why I saw it this way, but for me it struck that that bell on the side of an airplane vibe, and I was like, I contacted Andrew, and I said, hey, can I use this? I don't want to do anything commercial with it. What I want to do is I want to print it out on a vinyl decal and attach it to my Humvee. And I told him I was going to Iraq in a few months, and I just wanted that on my Humvee, right. Sweet. In the window, one in the window, and then one in the on the back of the on the back of the vehicle. And from then, Andrew and I just kept in touch, and eventually he came to me and said, "Hey, look, I have this story," and through several revisions of the script, we finally all got together, and he came out with his latest version, and not this version, but the version before that, there was this one scene with Lady America, which is the main character. That she has this interlude with this very shady character, and things go very bad for her. And I said to him, throughout the whole script, this was what caught me. This very Brubaker-esque underbelly to a very public superhero show that was out there. That caught me. The rest of it was okay, but yeah. this really sunk its teeth into me and started chewing. And he revised the script one more time with little tweaks here and there, and then we finally came out with what we have now. And if you go to the Kickstarter page, you can actually read the script, and it's in its entirety.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, it feels like this could happen to any of us. We all within us have this potential to take the pinnacle of what we could become and use that to good effect, but there will always be people who will try and pervert that. And to me, that's what this story says, despite what everybody, the direction everybody wants for you, despite what everybody tells you, this is what you have to do, this is what you should do with your life, this is how you should see yourself. We always have a choice as people, as whether we're in a society of free people or those who are subjugated, to stand up, put your hand out, and say, no, I'm going my way because it's my life and this is how I want to live it. And yeah, that's what I think.
You're an artist. You have an artist lined up, don't you?
Yes, we do. Alex Williamson. He is absolutely amazing.
I was about to say, that is, I'm just on the Kickstarter page now. It is great artwork.
Yeah, and he's done some tweaks to the character design for Lady America, and I wanted to talk about those a little bit, because I noticed that she's got a kind of a very distinctive body type.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, okay, I'll jump in now, and I'll give you a little bit of a backstory and a history, and then we're going to run out of time, and I'll have to say goodbye because Mike has to go back to work, but we'll do our best.
Okay, we got 20 minutes, so just talk fast, it'll be fine.
Okay, I'll talk fast. Lady America was created from a moment of pique and spite in a Villains and Vigilantes campaign in 1989, where a friend of mine at the time, who I'm no longer friends with, sadly, was really, really upset that I thought this picture Chris Achilleos had done of a female Captain America was really cool, and wouldn't that be a great concept? And him being a Captain America fan and a real dyed-in-the-wool purist,
yeah,
took great umbrage to it. So I immediately invented Lady America and introduced her to the campaign just to piss him off.
Yeah.
And she grew legs, and she ran from there. Now, here's where we're going to get a little Freudian. We all have a little thing called a preferred style of woman in our lives.
Sure.
And my friends over the years have always made fun of me because they know that my kryptonite is what we call a thin, pointy blonde, usually with small breasts. And I'm very like Sandel Bergman from Conan. You know what I mean? I definitely have a weakness for that, and I won't get into it, but the mention of Freud should tell you why. So I always said, I'm really tired of these busty, curvy, pontoony breasted, just these women don't look like superheroes. They look like whores, Like, I work out. I do martial arts. I'm around women who are athletic and combat-oriented, and they don't have these bodies until they go to Hollywood. I used to be a stuntman. And they get breast implants. You know what I mean? Otherwise, they tend to be very lean, small-muscled, ropey, long-limbed women with very small breasts, very athletic looks, narrow hips. Well, that's a superhero to me. That's a physical superhero. Yes, we're going to have a big titty woman in there, and yes, we're going to have hot women and all that, but Lady America's a real woman. And I want women who see her and read her to go, yeah, you know? Like, she's not Power Girl. She's not chest out to the nth degree and all that. She's the American Amazon. That's her nickname. She's a real, honest-to-God, Indiana, corn-fed blonde who, you know, as that line from Mariel Hemingway has in that movie Personal Best, I think it is, she's a carpenter's dream, you know, flat as a board and easy to nail, but bum-bum, shh. That's okay. Who she is.
So, how did you guys land out?
Well, we had another artist. Unfortunately, his life got in the way. And that artist we had gotten through, of all people, Jack Herman. And for those who know who that is, great guy. Gave us a glowing review, too. He's an awesome dude. And that guy, unfortunately, couldn't... his own life got in the way, and we couldn't come to a finished project. And I was scrambling. I was freaking out because my project was falling apart after a year of work. And then James Dossie and Dan Hauser introduced us to Alex, who'd been doing work for them.
Yep.
And then Alex and I clicked. And Alex said the thing after Walt had talked about, why are we, you know, this Lady America part at the start of the story is so much more interesting than all of this stuff about Invictus after. I mean, it's a good story, but... And Alex says to me, he goes, you know, it's funny. You've told me three things about how to draw Invictus, but you've given me an entire document on how to draw Lady America. Why is the story not about her?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when I went,
because it was clear that that's the character you really wanted to talk about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I had had a fear... I'll be honest, I had a fear of making her the first character, because how the hell can I write about a woman as my first character when I'm a man? But then I realized that the entire theme of my comic has always been and always will be about not just being heroic, but identity. Who are you? What do people think you're supposed to be? And who do you feel you should be? And that's led to the script we have, which I think really is on the road of that.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I think you made the right call. I remember years ago, I was running a writer's group out of a bookstore in Southern California. And we had a television writer come in, and he had been a career television writer for decades of the sort of golden age of television. You know, he had written for things like the Mary Tyler Moore Show and stuff like that. Anyway, he came in and he was talking about an episode of one of those shows. And I don't think it was Mary Tyler Moore. It was like the spinoff show or something, where he had written like the first lesbian scene on television. And he had said that, you know, he had been really self-conscious about it at first because, you know, people would say, well, how can you write about that? Because they always say, write what you know. He's like, well, look, I'm not a lesbian. How can I write this show? You know, but that's exactly that's the challenge, is writing things that aren't what you know, right?
Exactly. Or
sometimes... the understanding that we all kind of have some kind of shared human experience. I mean, whatever your color or your race or your religion or your country or nationality, creed, you know, there's something that is still universally human. And so why can't you write a story about all those people? Because there's something that we all share in common.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I agree with you 100% on that.
Yeah. So you did the right thing. You did the right thing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, the Jason Tondra seal of approval.
Did any of you read the script by any chance?
Only like three times, yeah.
Yeah, well, I know you've read it. I kept shoving it down your throat. Well, hang on, let's do that then. Mike Lafferty, you've read the script three times. What did you think? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I was reading Heroic back when I was about, you know, a little kid discovering his superpowers after his dad beat him in the Canadian Outback, so it's changed a lot.
It wasn't the Canadian Outback. It was in Montana. Come on now.
Sorry. All right.
So I know it seems like the same place. Yes, I know.
I think Walt's done it pretty well by saying Brubaker-esque. It really had that kind of a modern Captain America, you know, feel to it.
Well, there are certainly worse things to get compared to, my friend.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I would say it wasn't my intent to write Brubaker. In fact, I'd say I was more channeling Mark Miller than I was Brubaker at the time. Let me explain something. I said earlier I don't like camp. I also don't like people who make fun of superheroes. That does not include Ben Edlund, okay? Or the movie Mystery Men. Because they make fun of superheroes from a love of superheroes.
That's right. You're absolutely right. They do.
Yes. Garth Ennis hates superheroes. You can tell Garth Ennis hates superheroes, and when he got to the boys, it was like, okay, dude, we get it. You hate superheroes. Mark Miller loves superheroes. You can tell that Mark Miller loves superheroes, but he also loves edgy heist films, and he loves, you know, conspiracy theories and all that kind of stuff. So I see that much more, for me, what I like as well, but I also miss the Bronze Age, man. My period of comics has been and always will be, 1975 to 1985. That is the period of comics I love the most. I can read stuff from that time and be happy.
Yeah.
I wanted a little bit of that, too. So that's what I'm trying to do with Zenith, is I'm trying to build in the heroics of the line a little bit of a modern sensibility with a little bit of that 70s, you know, superheroes. You know, they're still... Max Landis said it in his latest review of Man of Steel. He says, they've focused so much on the super, they've forgotten the heroes.
So right now, it looks like your goal is a little over $10,000. And you had a great 24 hours. You've raised over $2,000 already.
We have, yeah. It's been... We got really lucky that this one tier that I created... based solely on a whim and a lark of there are three characters in the script who are just, you know, the scientist, the driver, and the security guard, but they all have a couple of pages worth of action and dialogue and excitement. So we said, you know what? You be in the comic. $500, we'll put you in the comic. And we've sold all three in the first 24 hours. Blows my mind.
Yeah, and the ones that I've done, people love it when they have a chance to incorporate, you know, their own, you know, be a part of it.
So that's a good strategy tip, you know, for anybody else out there that's thinking about doing this. Just put a few characters whose appearances can be changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good handle for covers.
And I can assure you that if we do move forward with issue one and we get to an issue, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then we have a second arc goes up to issue 12. So 12 issues in 2 arcs. If we get to issue 2, already there's a villain we are introducing in issue 1 called Johnny Blades. And he's a speedster with knives who's a bit of a psychopath. And Johnny Blades is a very deep, good friend of mine who supported me from the start with this project, encouraged me all the way, and was such a great booster of the project, I swore to God I'd put him in it. And we came up with this character of Johnny Blades. I always wanted to do a knife-based speedster anyway, so here he is. So moving forward, we have this entire world of villains and new heroes to populate.
Yeah.
So when we get to issue 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, we're going to be opening up people to actually become heroes and villains in the universe as well.
Okay.
And that, I think, is a neat idea for us.
Yeah.
I'd like to be your ambush bug character, if that's possible.
You already are, Mike. You already are. Just wear that big hat.
To the ambush bug of our hearts, Mike.
Why you guys got to bust balls? All right. All right, so Kickstarter is going well. We'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Thank you.
Now, you guys are, you know, you're kind of a joint partnership of a gaming company and a comics company. Are we going to see any kind of gaming material coming out of the Zenith Comic Universe?
Oh, Walt.
Yeah, I'm right here.
That's you, baby.
Poised on the ledge and ready to jump. you got pretty much on the heels of this Kickstarter, we're looking at doing the same thing with our gaming property, which is Supers. And one of the things that sort of has taken on a life of its own is a mini setting for that. And depending on how popular it is, we'll... throughout the Kickstarter process will determine the amount of legs that we're going to put under it to help carry it.
Yeah.
So that could be a tie-in right there.
Okay.
Well, is Supers a system that's already out, or is it something you guys have been in playtesting, or what? What's its status?
Yeah, Supers is a system that's already out. It was
okay.
It was written by Simon Washburn back in 2010, and then pushed forward. But it had a small but dedicated following, but it hasn't. Yep. It never really got it never got any wind under its sails. So
sure,
Andrew heard that Simon was looking to give the wheel to someone else, and he said, you know, he figuratively grabbed me by the shirt, started shaking me, and said, "Dude, we got to buy this." So.
We were at the time talking about making our own version of a superhero game based on the old Marvel Phase Rip.
Yeah.
And then this opportunity came along.
So now we have we're almost done with the writing for the revised edition, and it's not a new edition, it's just going to be some rules clarifications, adding some tweaks and bits in there, and then
those of us that have not seen Supers, can you tell me what distinguishes it from other superhero RPGs?
Supers is probably the one RPG I've seen that takes classic comic book superhero action and actually allows you to do it. So in other words, instead of Mutants and Masterminds, where everything is hardline stats and then you have to use action points or hero points to manipulate certain things, your super right out of the gate can already do fantastic things. So, for example, you got Ben Grimm lifting up a car and throwing it at Mr. Fantastic because he's mad that Mr. Fantastic didn't make his famous spaghetti and meatballs that night.
Sure.
So, in a regular superhero game, you'd have to use Mr. Fantastic's agility to dodge this or that, and then maybe his stretching ability to whatever, but he's a smart guy. What if he uses his intelligence to calculate the trajectory of the car?
Sure.
And do something interesting with it in that vein.
Yeah.
So you don't have to just rely on the stats, and it's very narrative in how it works.
Okay.
So, like, just because you know one super throws a car at another super, and you don't have to catch it. Instead, you could use your I-beams to blast it aside. You could, all of those stunts are programmed in there from the beginning.
Exactly.
So you can sort of put anything on your character sheet to accomplish any action if you come up with a good reason.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
It's all about selling what you're doing and having a narrator who's open to it.
Yeah.
If you're the kind of player who likes the champions, mutants, and masterminds, micromanagement, minute detail, you will not like superheroes. You will not like it.
Well, but it sounds more appeal to more storytelling games like Fate.
Exactly. Exactly. I introduced it to my group, and we played 3 or 4 sessions of it, and my players, after the first session, when it finally clicked on what they were doing, and they got their brain out of the old style of gaming and into the new style, loved it. They had a blast.
Yeah, there's almost always... I just got finished running a 7-hour Fate session just 2 days ago, and most of my players were from the sort of D&D, you know, kind of school, and so there's definitely some culture shift there, you know, like that you have to take a few hours to get through the change in paradigm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, when we get to the Kickstarter for this one, we're going to... Mike wants us to run a game. We're going to definitely do a session of Supers here for the Banff podcast, because, you know, Banff also means badass motherfucker, and I'd like to think we all are.
Is that what that stands for, really?
I don't know, but it does in my life.
So my parole officer says, too.
And then one of the things when we get to that Kickstarter we might have is, like, you know, buy a Skype game for you and 4 of your friends type of thing that myself or Walt will run or will run together or something, you know. So we're going to be promoting it a lot. Unfortunately, at this moment in time, the comic's my world, so I have to let Walt focus on this stuff.
As well it should be. We have to get your comic rolling first.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
Well, hey, guys, I got to get back to the shackles of my corporate paymasters. anything else? Is someone making a latte in the background?
That's me pouring some water. My apologies.
Oh, no worries. Anything we want to touch on before we call it a podcast?
Thanks, Mike, and thanks to everybody else for coming.
Indeed. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. Please go to the Kickstarter. Check it out. Read the script. Look at the art. Watch my crazy, shaky video. Enjoy it.
Walt, Aid, anything?
Not I love you all.
We love you too, Will.
Take care.
All right. Hey, thanks, folks, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Take care. Thanks for talking, guys. Appreciate it.
You bet.